my gosh, we're so excited. Yes. We got our first donation.
Woot, woot.
We've been begging for money at the end of our podcast for so long.
We have.
And you'll never guess who gave us our first money.
Who?
Our number one stan, Diane.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you, Diane. We love you.
We
keep
love
listening.
You. And keep giving us suggestions. Actually, no, the list is too long now. Hello, beautiful humans. I'm Tiny Castle.
And I'm Benjamin Mead.
And you're listening to Just a Minute. Just a Minute is an educational podcast where we break down justice topics in 30 minutes or less. Today's topic, Native Americans and the FBI. Hello, and thanks for joining us. Hello, Ben.
Well, hi, Tommy, and hello, listeners. Thanks.
Hello,
thanks for
listeners.
Yeah.
I haven't checked the numbers, so I hope we have gained some listeners after marketing our podcast.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
So if you're new, thanks for tuning in.
Thanks a lot.
And if you are a regular listener, we love you so much.
We love you. So on Monday of this week, we held the inaugural Indigenous Peoples Day celebration at JMU, where Dr. Lindsay Harville Bowman of Osage Nation presented on her background and tribe. And Dr. Peggy Plass and I discussed the historical relationship with the FBI. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah. So we're recording this in October.
Yes. By the time you hear it, we will not.
Yeah,
it will be in the same week.
November or December, maybe. Mm-hmm. But should we mention the correct terms to you?
Yes,
so we
yes,
talked
yes.
about Indigenous Peoples Day, but
yes.
Native American and Indian are both appropriate terms for American Indigenous peoples.
Absolutely.
And the best practice is usually to be as precise as possible.
Right.
Refer to groups by their Indigenous names, the Osage, the Cherokee. So that's, you know, best when possible, if you know. But Indigenous groups in other parts of the world also have different preferences about
yes.
appropriate terms. So if you're not sure, it's always best to ask or
yes.
refer to people as they refer to themselves.
And this did come up in our Q&A. And so the Osage Nation members there, Lindsay and her mother, did talk about the fact that Indian was perfectly acceptable and did not offend them.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that you were not able to attend that first part due
yeah.
to class, but what did you or do you or did you know about Osage Nation and the book, now film, Killers of the Flower Moon before this week?
Nothing. Nope. Totally ignorant.
Absolutely.
I'd heard you talk about, you know, Lindsay being Osage before.
Right.
But I don't know anything about the Osage, and I don't know anything about the book. I think the title sounds like really cool. Like
yes.
Killers of the Flower Moon. It's cool sounding, and I wanted to know what the significance of the flower moon is.
Yes.
But the flower moon is just the full moon in May.
Yeah.
It's just called the flower moon because it's the full moon when the flowers are
yeah.
blooming.
It's still a cool title,
yeah,
though.
That's it. But
yeah.
apparently the first killings began, or I think the first victim was discovered in May
yes.
of 1921 during the flower moon. So.
Right. And the book by David Gran is actually called Killers of the Flower Moon and the Birth of the FBI, which is kind of what we're starting off our discussion about today. So I just want to mention that what I'm talking about today is kind of a combination of what Peggy and I both discussed during that presentation. But the film is a Martin Scorsese.
Mm-hmm.
How do you say that correctly? I don't think I've ever.
I didn't really even could tell much difference in the two different ways you pronounced it. So you're good, I think.
Our Italian American listeners are going to kill us. I'm sorry. So anyway, it's a film that got a 9-minute standing ovation at the film festival. I'll likely skip it due to its more than 3-hour running time. I can't sit in a movie theater that long anymore.
Yeah, that's definitely a catching your home theater flick.
Yeah, because you can pause and go to the restroom, you know, get something to eat, pet a cat, you know, all those things.
Sure.
Anyway, the book and the film focus on the members of the Osage tribe in northeastern Oklahoma who are murdered under mysterious circumstances starting in the 1920s.
Mm.
And this sparked a major investigation by the BOI, which was the precursor to the FBI. The Bureau of Investigation was created in 1908 by Attorney General Charles Bonaparte, who was instructed to create an investigative agency by President Roosevelt that would only report to the AG. So the Bureau's first official task was visiting and making surveys of the houses of prostitution in preparation for enforcing the White Slave Traffic Act, or Mann Act, passed in 1910.
Or shouldn't we say houses of sex work?
Yes.
I said prostitutes in our last episode.
And I corrected you.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Right after I said sex workers. Mm-hmm. That would be the appropriate terminology. So the FBI went through several name changes, becoming the United States Bureau of Investigation in 1932, the Division of Investigation in 1933, and then finally landing on the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which was an independent service under the DOJ or Department of Justice in 1935. So J. Edgar Hoover was the director of these iterations beginning in 1924.
So there's the birth of the FBI.
Correct. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's kind of like a misnomer to say that that time period when the murder started is the birth of the FBI, because it was already, you know, kind of an organization at that point.
The birth of the name change of the FBI.
Yeah, and it wasn't a great organization to begin with. It was pretty corrupt. There was no training. Yeah. Anyway, so the Osage, as Lindsay discussed in her presentation, originally lived in Arkansas. But like most tribes in the 18th and 19th century, they were forced to give up their ancestral land and move west to Kansas. As was also typical of the experience of many Native people, white settlers later came to occupy the land of the reservation, forcing the Osage out through violence and sketchy land purchases. So the tribe displaced, purchased another reservation in Oklahoma on land which they felt sure white people would not want. Yeah. But dun dun dun, what was found there?
Oil.
Oil. Yeah. Oil. Say that with a, how do you say that in Southwestern Virginia?
Oil.
Oil.
Oh, yeah. Go get your oil check. Check your oil. Oil. Change your oil. Oil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So but oil was found.
Land rich with oil. So
yes. Yeah,
we just like kids who only want to play with a toy once we see somebody else playing with it. Yes. See that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So by the time the murders began in the 1920s, members of the tribe were quite wealthy, being among the most wealthy people in the USA or the world.
Wow.
Each member of the tribe received annual payments from the oil profits, much as now happens with the profits from tribal casinos. Mm-hmm. So the book and now the film focuses on the story of Molly Burkhart. She was married to a white man.
And my sister's name is Molly.
Yes.
Spelled the same way with an I-E.
With an I-E.
Y is more common, but.
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm seeing a lot more Mollies in my classes these days. I think I have like two this semester.
I have one.
The name's making a comeback.
It is. Mm-hmm. So she was married to a white man named Ernest Burkhart, and he was the nephew of William Hale, the so-called king of the Osage Hills. Mm-hmm. So he was a wealthy land owner and cattleman.
A cattleman?
A cattleman.
Half cattle, half man?
Yes.
All, as we will soon find out, murderous son of a gun?
Yeah. Spoiler alert.
Oh, spoiler alert.
Anyway, I'm just getting through the story to get to the FBI connection, right?
Yeah,
so
true.
The Osage were wealthy, but they were not allowed to have control over their own money. They had to have a white male guardian. Mm-hmm. So beginning in 1918, members of Molly's family died under suspicious circumstances. Other members of the tribe outside of Molly's family were also killed. And while there is some lack of certainty about the total body count in this killing spree, as many as 60 people, most of them members of the Osage tribe, were ultimately murdered.
Gosh, that's a lot, 60 people.
Yeah.
Were they poisoned? Wasn't that what I was hearing from?
No. Some of them were. Like, it was a combination of strategies used to kill them. Mm. So the wasting disease, the mysterious wasting disease, yes, that was poisoning, and Molly was being poisoned also, but she actually lived. So the motive for these crimes were financial. You know, white people were seeking to obtain the head right or the money from oil leases to which Osage tribal members were entitled. And these head rights could be inherited by non-Osage people, hence the motive for the killings. As Lindsay explained, her grandfather's mineral rights passed to her mother and her aunts and uncles and will pass to her. But because of these murders, they can no longer go to non-Osage spouses.
Well, that's a sensible precaution.
Yeah. So as she mentioned, Trent, her husband who was there, he, you know, like if he kills her, he's not going to get it. He's not going to get the money. So the connection to the FBI is that local law enforcement were like somewhat unwilling or unable to address the massacre. Because the Osage had money, they were able to hire a number of private detectives to investigate. And some of those were murdered themselves.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so none of these men discovered any conclusive evidence, and some of them appeared to actually be working against the discovery of the truth, because I'm sure they were being bribed. But when you see how much money we're talking about, it's a lot. In 1923, the Osage Tribal Council asked the federal government for help in solving the existing murders and preventing new killings, and the fledgling BOI was charged with bringing the murderers to justice. It was Hoover that assigned the agents who broke the case. Okay. J. Edgar Hoover, the most famous director. Yes. So that team, which also included a Native American undercover officer, found that Bill Hale, the king of the Osage Hills, was responsible, assisted by his nephew, Molly's husband, and all of the murders had been designed to allow Hale and his associates to take control of the oil profits. So just to give you an idea here, Molly's husband would inherit her oil payments if she died, which would be around $9 million today.
Like, and how often would you get the, is it like total $9 million or is it like $9 million
you get
a month?
That, you get the annual payments.
Annual, okay. Mm-hmm. Wow.
So it was a conspiracy and there were others involved, but most of them were never convicted of crimes. Like the people who were charged with murders, but there's a larger conspiracy. Yeah. Some people were never identified.
And that's a real conspiracy. Not just a conspiracy theory.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So the FBI was great in that regard, that they helped solve these murders, but they actually didn't stop the killings. After Hale was imprisoned, they continued. And there were also many of the murders that couldn't be attributed to any of the suspects, ultimately tried and jailed.
So it's not like the cattleman was the only person killing members of Osage.
No, there was quite an incentive to kill them off. And, you know, we cannot, like, minimize racism, xenophobia, you know, all of these things that, you know, like, allowed them to see Osage as less than human. Mm-hmm. So it was easy to murder them.
Yeah. Okay, so now I guess we need to fast forward in our time machine. Groovy 1970s. So you talked about the way that the FBI assisted Native Americans with the Osage murders. But also there was a period of time when the relationship between FBI and Native peoples was not so great.
Yes. And so what I just covered is pretty much what Peggy talked about. And I introduced, you know, sort of the bad relationship here. So what we're going to begin talking about here is COINTELPRO, which is a counterintelligence program that began around 1956 because Hoover was frustrated that the Supreme Court had limited the Justice Department's ability to prosecute people for their political opinions, primarily communists.
Darn that Supreme Court.
He was very, very anti-communist. He was obsessed with communism.
Yeah.
So this was a dirty tricks program designed originally to disrupt the Communist Party, but became much larger in scope.
Yeah.
The program was covert and illegal, surveilling, infiltrating, and disrupting political organizations that they deemed subversive or radical, including everything from the anti-Vietnam War protesters and organizers, black civil rights activists, animal rights, feminist organizations, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And what's relevant to this discussion, the American Indian Movement, or AIM. So COINTELPRO remained in place until it was exposed in 1971 by activist who burglarized an office in Media, PA. The program was investigated by a congressional committee in 1975 and deemed illegal and unconstitutional.
Yeah, and it's the same program that was responsible for the infamous suicide letter to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Yes.
That disclosed details about his extramarital sex life that the FBI learned about from wiretaps, I'm assuming illegal, on his phone.
Illegal wiretaps. Yeah.
And Hoover called King a tomcat with degenerative sexual urges.
Obsessive degenerate.
Oh, an obsessive degenerate. an obsessive degenerate sexual urge tomcat that, and this was disclosed to the press in an attempt to discredit him, but it went nowhere. And it was one of Hoover's deputies, William Sullivan, who wrote the anonymous letter and sent an agent to Miami to mail the package to Atlanta.
Yes. And this was, you know, like we saw a redacted version of this letter. So it's only relatively recently that we got all of the content. So Hoover had set these wiretaps up for King because he was looking for communism, you know, like he was obsessed with that. And all they uncovered was some of this. But it didn't matter. It didn't do anything. It didn't help discredit King. So AIM began in Minneapolis, Minnesota in 1968. AIM leaders were concerned with the high unemployment rates, the slum housing, or what were called red ghettos of the cities that indigenous people, you know, were forced to live in, and racist treatment by police. So they were also agitating for treaty rights and reclamation of tribal lands. AIM was primarily an urban movement due to prior Indian relocation policies that encouraged Native Americans to leave reservations for cities for better employment opportunities. But all they found was poverty, basically, and illness. So as one of the many political organizations under surveillance by the FBI, AIM became more of a national security threat and focus after a couple of key events in AIM's history. So these include the occupation of Alcatraz, which was led by Richard Oakes and was primarily an indigenous college student movement. These pan-Indian groups were primarily an urban phenomenon. They were in cities such as Oakland because of those Indian relocation policies. They had lost in connection to their ancestral land and their tribal culture. So oral history among Native Americans about the land that Alcatraz was built on was that it was used for many tribes for purposes of isolation, camping, and gathering food. So it is historically indigenous land. So that occupation ended by federal involvement, of course, but then in 1972, there was a national effort among tribal organizations to voice their grievances against the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the BIA, for perceived corruption and how they were using money devoted to tribal organizations, and they also wanted to protest broken treaties. So this action, called the Trail of Broken Treaties, was a protest march from the West Coast to D.C., which ended with the occupation of these offices.
That's a long way.
That is a long way. Yes, and it was recreated. That walk was recreated. Finally, the occupation of Wounded Knee was a protest against a corrupt neo-colonial tribal government, which the U.S. government had sent in the FBI to protect. So the Oglala people of the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota wanted rid of the chairman, who hired vigilantes known as the Goons, guardians of the Oglala Nation. They were actually called the Goons, which the FBI gave material support, ammunition, and other funds.
So basically, like, the tribal leader government was in cahoots with the federal government against their own people?
Yes, the more traditional, so there were progressive Oglala folks on this reservation. He was misusing funds. Like, he was just corrupt. He's indigenous. He was Oglala himself, but he was corrupt. And so in order to protect his profits as well as his political stance, he got this vigilante group, the Goons, which were made up of mostly white men, but also some indigenous folks that he bribed. So anyway, they wanted rid of him. They hired these vigilantes, and the FBI supported this. During this time, the FBI was using the dirty tactics described earlier, including infiltration by FBI informant Douglas Durham. The goal was to destroy and suppress the movement because AIM had weapons, and the occupation resulted in more than one firefight with marshals, FBI agents, and actually Nixon illegally sent in the U.S. Army to intervene. Peace attempts failed. Once the federal government refused to negotiate until AIM disarmed, and they refused to do so. So there were many suspicious events surrounding murders of AIM activists and their subsequent investigations or lack thereof. One individual stated that the death of AIM activists went uninvestigated, even though there was an abundance of FBI agents on Pine Ridge Reservation at the time.
Yeah,
they're trying to destroy the movement, so they're not going to investigate the murders, right? Yeah. So the one that's attributed to this whole, you know, kind of COINTELPRO process is Annie Mae Aquash. And she was an activist who had been present at Wounded Knee. She was later suspected of being a spy for the government. And this is an example of snitch jacketing where they attempted to discredit her mm-hmm. and make it seem as though she was an FBI informant, which the work of the actual FBI mm-hmm. informant did this, right? Mm-hmm. So it was him who was making her look like she was the informant when it was him.
Yeah.
So two AIM members were convicted of her murder. But it was the FBI tactics of subterfuge mm-hmm. that led to this.
So like falsely accusing or planting evidence that this person is a snitch.
Yes.
So they'll get taken out.
Like making sure mm-hmm. that the FBI goes up and speaks to her directly and everyone sees her. She got arrested mm-hmm. and released very quickly right before her death.
Oh,
you know, like those
okay.
kinds of
oh,
multiple,
okay. yeah.
multiple mm-hmm. activities that make it look like you're working mm-hmm. with the FBI. So,
and then I'm sure the undercover guy was also like stoking.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And he actually got all the way up to AIM leadership. So he had a lot of power. So a former FBI agent who worked for the program stated that the goal was to get them to kill each other because they were at war with AIM.
Yeah.
The paranoia that develops once everyone is suspected of being a possible informant would increase the violence as they turn on each other. The tribal chairman made the situation much worse because he was a corrupt politician. He wanted to keep his power, and so he called in the federal government to back him up. They established roadblocks. They blocked and even shot at food drops. So there were anti-war protesters who got mm-hmm. helicopters and tried to drop mm-hmm. food because they were starving them out.
Oh, okay.
And so, the federal government shot mm-hmm. at the food mm-hmm. drops. They shot the food so that
you
couldn't
eat
it.
Yeah. At first I was thinking like, well, they just like blow the food away or are they
yes.
shooting at the helicopter or just
both.
All of the above?
Yes. They actually shot mm-hmm. the food mm-hmm. so that they didn't have anything mm-hmm. to eat. So, and they engaged in regular firefights with AIM. Ultimately, 2,500 federal personnel assigned to this mm-hmm. and were assigned to this occupation and eventually two mm-hmm. FBI agents pursuing someone onto the reservation in unmarked cars and in plain clothes were murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Two people were acquitted by a jury because they used a self-defense. They did not know that these mm-hmm. were FBI agents. They mm-hmm. had not identified themselves and they were not wearing anything mm-hmm. that said they were FBI. But Leonard Pelter was convicted and remains mm-hmm. in prison today.
Mm. And is that how the siege ended?
Yes. So, the siege mm-hmm. ends. So kind of another side note in how I got interested in this particular story was a book written about this occupation. It's how I found out about mm-hmm. the vigilante group, the Goons, led to several libel lawsuits, including by an FBI-supported special agent. They wanted to prevent the publication, which they were able to do so by holding it up in lawsuits for a decade.
Mm.
One thing discussed in the book is the ballistics evidence that withheld at the time of Pelter's trial, which a judge stated during appeals would likely have been enough to acquit him at trial, but it didn't rise to the level of standard required for a new trial.
If this would have been introduced at your first trial, you wouldn't have been found guilty, but it's not worth giving
exactly.
a new trial. That seems ridiculous.
Yeah. So with that, maybe we should note mm-hmm. some of the ways that the FBI is working on indigenous issues today in a more positive way.
Yeah, so in going back to the Osage murders, the FBI's intervention there kind of established a precedent of FBI responding to crimes on tribal land. So federal law enforcement is often called upon today to help in situations where there might be issues of corruption in local police or political groups. The FBI has some jurisdiction on some Indian reservations, on some native lands, and takes responsibility for some kinds of investigations conjointly with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Office of Justice Services. And most of those cases involve violent crimes, things like murder investigations or death investigations, physical, sexual abuse of children, sexual assaults against women. And of course, we have seen increasing awareness recently of the problem of missing or mm-hmm. murdered indigenous people, and women in particular. So they've been assisting in cases of missing and murdered indigenous
yes.
women. Task force was created, the Missing and Murdered Unit, to investigate this issue and also collaborates, collaboration between the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the FBI.
Right.
And then also Savannah's Act was signed into law in 2020, which was a bipartisan effort to improve federal response to missing or murdered indigenous people.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that wraps it up, so unless you got anything else.
I do not.
All right. Well, that means that it is our Minute to Spin It, where we both give our takeaway from today's episode. So, Tommy, in just a minute, what's your spin?
So my spin today is more advocacy because we just celebrated Indigenous Peoples Day.
Yeah.
And even though that act was signed into law in 2020 and we're doing, you know, kind of all of this stuff to improve investigation of murdered Indigenous women, the federal government is still taking land and using land. And Standing Rock shows us that if we want to do something like dam a river or build a pipeline, that the federal government has no problem breaking treaties and continuing to break treaties with Native Americans. They also have, you know, as Lindsay spoke about in her presentation, Osage is unique and an exception because they have such great health care and they have a campus and university community. And because of their money and their wealth. They're able to advocate for themselves and pay for things for themselves. The federal government absolutely needs to do more. Because most of these reservations are in rural areas. They need better health care. They need to, you know, help getting out of poverty, food, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, advocate.
As you said, hopefully the FBI and we as a society can be more aware of the violence and victimization and mistreatment of Native peoples and work to make things better.
Yes. We are a community-driven podcast sponsored by the Gandhi Center, a nonprofit which relies on support from generous donors like yourselves. If you would like to support our educational programming, click on the link in our show notes to provide a modest donation.